Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ina Ramos, and I'd like to welcome you to the Minority Fellowship Program webinar on understanding and addressing adverse childhood experiences during and beyond the COVID-19 pandemic. This webinar is brought to you by the SAMHSA Minority Fellowship Program Coordinating Center. Disclaimer, the views, opinions, and content expressed in this presentation do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, or policies of the Center for Mental Health Services, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, or the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And now I'd like to introduce today's presenter. Dr. April Joy Damian is an epidemiologist, health services researcher, and classically trained public health professional with expertise in health equity, social determinants of health, psychiatric epidemiology, and mixed methods. She currently serves as the associate director of the Weizmann Institute, a research, education, and policy center dedicated to quality improvement and primary care transition with a particular focus on vulnerable populations. Dr. Damian is also the immediate past chair of the Academy Health Public Health Systems Research IG Advisory Board and concurrently holds faculty appointments at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and Wesleyan University. Dr. Damian previously served as the Director of Quality Innovation at the National Quality Forum, or NQF. In this role, Dr. Damian spearheaded the expansion of NQF's portfolio on social determinants of health quality measures and co-led the NQF Measure Incubator, an innovative effort that facilitates efficient measure development and testing through collaboration and partnership, and addresses important aspects of care for which quality measures are underdeveloped or non-existent. Dr. Damian completed her PhD in the Department of Mental Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and Master's in Medical Sciences at Harvard Medical School. She graduated Phi Beta Kappa from the University of California, Berkeley, with a Bachelor's of Arts in Ethnic Studies, highest honors. She has worked with several reputable governing bodies, including the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, Veteran Health Administration in Washington, D.C., International Organization for Migration in Geneva, Switzerland, as well as local health departments on policy and programs relating to improving healthcare access and quality for medically underserved communities. She has received numerous recognitions in honor of her role as a social change agent, including the Harry S. Truman Scholarship, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation-funded Community Wellbeing Warrior Award, and an honorarium from the University of Delaware. Dr. Damian, the floor is now yours.
So thanks, Ina. Thanks to the staff at SAMHSA, and thank you all for being able to join on this rainy Wednesday, at least if you're like me and are based in Washington, D.C. So hopefully I make this next hour and a half or 85 minutes with all of you meaningful. So I'm not going to go into accolades or exactly what I do, because I think Ina did a great job with that. I think it's important to level set, though, with all of you in terms of how I got into this field of, you know, childhood trauma, or as we're going to refer to as adverse childhood experiences. I think it really stems from, you know, me having grown up in San Francisco in California, now based in D.C., traveled to different places and worked both internationally and domestically, and really, you know, feeling that my purpose is really to, you know, improve people's health and to bring healing. I saw a lot of, you know, mental health challenges among adults, all kinds of health conditions from diabetes to heart disease. And in realizing that, you know, a lot of these health conditions seen in adulthood, a lot of them related to things that happened in their childhood, right? And in knowing that patients and families and communities I had interacted with, that it wasn't just them, but it was their relatives and it was children. So this intergenerational trauma, and then understanding childhood trauma within childhood, right? And understanding how it influences not only how they do in school, their health, their overall well-being, how they interact with others in their circles. So understanding the short and long-term consequences and impacts. across the life course of adverse childhood experiences is really what drove me to pursue this topic. Then there's the flip side of resiliency, right? Like the trauma and experiencing a traumatic event or having traumatic experiences does not have to be the end of the story, right? There are ways that we as a field can respond. There are ways to build resiliency and build stronger communities, stronger families, and stronger children. So I hope that even in the midst of a very challenging public health topic to address, a very meaningful one, that we come away knowing that there is hope and there's a way that we're able to address these issues. So there are three objectives to my talk today. First is to understand the epidemiology of ACEs and its short and long-term impact on health outcomes over the life course, to examine ACEs in the context of COVID-19, because we're all trying to relate our topics of interest to the current public health crisis, and then to explore recommendations and opportunities for addressing ACEs through research, policy, and practice, because I imagine many of you wear multiple hats, maybe are clinical researchers or clinicians interested in health policy. So I hope you walk away with some ways to apply lessons learned from this talk, or if not, to reaffirm what you might already know and build on it. This is a word cloud to really provide an overview of the first objective of that I mentioned in the last slide. So I'm going to ask Steve at this point to cue the video, which provides a great overview of ACEs, particularly a summary of the original ACEs study led by Filetti and Anda, and some key terms and concepts. So basically, the takeaway from the video, there are three types of ACEs, or there's a way to classify the types of ACEs, right? So abuse, neglect, and household dysfunction, and there's images there. As the video noted, there were 10 ACEs identified by the Kaiser study, right? So physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. Two types of neglect, physical and emotional, and then household dysfunction, which includes mental illness, mother treated violently, divorce, having an incarcerated relative, or substance abuse in the house, which are not all encompassing, right? For many of you, you are clinicians or practitioners or researchers, policymakers. We know that these 10 ACEs done in the study close to almost 30 years ago is not all, doesn't fully capture all adverse experiences. So often when we refer to these particular adverse childhood experiences, we say the capital ACEs, right? The capital ACES. We also recognize the shortcomings of these studies. So for all of us, for those of us on this call who work in the health equity and health disparities spaces, we recognize that the study, you know, was done on a predominantly upper middle class white population with at least a college education, which is not necessarily representative of the populations that many of us aim to serve through our work. So as I'll go through this presentation, knowing that this is a seminal study and knowing that there are limitations, but there's still a lot we can take away from it, I wanted to make sure that we also talked about other conditions, not necessarily covered, but definitely associated with ACEs, such as poverty, police and community violence, food insecurity, and discrimination, which have yet to be included as part of these original 10 ACEs. There's also population adverse experiences. So if we look at the year 2020, a year that go down in history in terms of national disasters, public health challenges, national economic instability, war, if we're thinking more globally, wanting to understand these new adverse experiences, including the COVID-19 pandemic, are still to be discussed and to be examined further. So just wanted to recognize, while a seminal study, there are still many knowledge and implementation gaps which our field aims to address. I just wanted to give a high-level summary of key findings from the ACEs study, which I think the video did succinctly and beautifully, as well as subsequent body of research. I know Ina provided as an attachment the different references, so feel free to look those up on your own time. You can always reach out to me as well. So basically three things. One, that ACEs are highly prevalent, as you see here. They're strongly associated in a dose response fashion with some of the most common and serious health conditions, So by dose response, right, the higher the ACE score, the higher the likelihood of having many of these highly common medical and behavioral conditions. And that ACEs affect all communities, right? That's what it noted in the video. Although there are disparity, while affecting all communities, we also recognize that there are disparities in terms of prevalence, which I'll go into in the next few slides. So many states are collecting information about ACEs through the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, which I'll commonly refer to as BRFSS. So this is an annual state-based random digital telephone survey that collects data from non-institutionalized U.S. adults regarding health conditions and risk factors. So since 2009, 48 states plus the District of Columbia have included ACE questions for at least 1 year on their survey. The BRFSS ACEs module specifically was adapted from the original CDC Kaiser ACE study and is used to collect information on child abuse and neglect and household challenges. The module is available in both English and Spanish. It is not copyrighted. There are no fees for the use of the questionnaires. ACEs are categorized into two groups in this module, abuse and household challenges. Neglect was not added until more recently in 2019. So states have added the ACE module using their own resources. They're not necessarily required to report back their data to CDC's BRFSS, but you can definitely look up on the BRFSS webpage for a list of state coordinators and wherever you are in the country. This study by Giano and colleagues, you know, looked at ACEs data using the BRFSS for over 200,000 adults and looked at prevalence of different ACEs as well as different ACE scores. So just wanted to show, you know, the frequencies in terms of different ACEs. I think what's more interesting though, if you are like me and are interested, you know, have a commitment to health equity, is understanding that yes, while the video did note that ACEs affects all people, you know, of different backgrounds and communities, that there are in fact disparities in terms of who is more likely to experience ACEs, right? So I note here, particular vulnerabilities to ACEs include females, younger adults, sexual minorities, and multiracial individuals, right? So understanding that although groups of all different sociodemographics are impacted, some are more highly susceptible and more impacted than others. I know this is a stressful time for everyone, but I wanted to give an overview of stress, right? There is such thing as positive stress, tolerable stress, and toxic stress. Not all stress is bad, right? Like, so understanding that those of us who are particularly interested in the earlier stages of the life course, that, you know, sometimes stressful situations can contribute to your growth and that you're able to get through it, right? So what does it mean to understand that not all stress necessarily leads to doom, right? So children, for example, who have supportive relationships experience tolerable stress, not toxic stress, right? So the stress that comes with studying for an exam, right? We've all been there, study for exams. But when you have, you know, study groups, a teacher or a professor who's providing the right type of instruction and support, it's tolerable stress, right? It is helping us build our knowledge, not necessarily toxic stress. The key difference between tolerable and toxic stress is how it affects the body's stress response, right? So tolerable stress is temporary, right? Like that exam, eventually you take it and it's over. Whereas toxic stress is prolonged activation of the autonomic nervous system. So it's this fight or flight response, with tolerable stress being short term and toxic being more long term, right? So knowing that the difference that having a supportive family, friend, teacher, clinician, provider, just that positive support in one's life can make the difference between toxic and tolerable stress in response to trauma. So Newman and Blackburn argue that children may be able to overcome and grow from single episodes of maltreatment, but to recognize that as risk factors accumulate, right, so this cumulative trauma, a child's capacity to endure them diminishes, right? So it's like this revved up car that, you know, okay, to keep your car running for those of you, us who drive. But after a while, right, it's the car will give. So what does this mean when there's this prolonged exposure to trauma and the accumulation of risk and harm? Research to date has shown that this is far more predictive and far more valuable in informing practice than viewing isolated incidences of adversity and violations, right? So what does it mean to look not necessarily at a single episode of child abuse or a single episode of neglect, but understanding this whole picture, whole child approach when we're looking at toxic stress? A prolonged period in which risks are already acknowledged as increasing vulnerability in children, as this is happening, understanding how environmental factors, right, so conditions outside of the household can enforce the risk factors that are happening in the household, right? So what does it mean for us to look at the child, if you're thinking of the Bronfenbrenner model, not only within the context of their family or the household, but also what is going on in the larger community, right? So just wanting to understand the long-term consequences of toxic stress physiologically, but also how different stressors, you know, both within the household as well as external to the household, can interact with each other to have this prolonged effects on a child. I mentioned earlier about this dose response relationship between ACEs and negative health outcomes. So I just wanted to show here, you know, different examples. As the ACE score goes up, there's an increased risk. And this has been supported time and time again with different studies in terms of negative influences of behavior, whether that be lack of physical activity, drug use, smoking, physical and mental health challenges, everything from diabetes and depression to stroke and cancer and injury. So as I noted in the beginning, you know, my interest in the latter topics is what drew me to ACEs, recognizing that, you know, what are the root causes? Can we go earlier in one's life to understand how they got to where they are, right? I wanted to take the next few slides to really walk through the implications of ACEs, at least the negative consequences of ACEs over the life course, right? There's the short-term effects of ACEs, looking at ACEs within childhood, but also into adulthood, right? So that it doesn't just stop in childhood. But let's start first with pediatric health. So the effects of toxic stress can be detected as early as infancy. So in babies, high dose of adversity has been associated with failure to thrive, growth delay, sleep disruption, and developmental delay. In school-age children, studies have found increased risk for viral infections, pneumonia, asthma, and other atopic diseases, as well as difficulties with learning and behavior. And then among adolescents with high ACEs, somatic complaints, including headaches, abdominal pain, increased engagement in high-risk behaviors, teen pregnancy, teen paternity, transmission of or STIs, mental health disorders, and substance use are all common. And we're looking at adult health. This is one study by Hugh and colleagues, but other studies have found consistent results in terms of higher ACE score, having a greater likelihood to experience mental health disorders such as depression, PTSD, anxiety, sleep disorders, and to engage in risky behaviors such as early and high-risk sexual behaviors and substance use. So the higher the ACE score, the greater risk for ACE-associated health conditions. This sums up the last three slides in terms of looking at the impact of ACEs across the life course, right? So looking at that generational trauma, how it impacts different social conditions, the root cause of ACEs leading to different mental, behavioral, emotional health challenges across the life course and eventually early death. Right. So understanding the impact of ACEs across the continuum. As I noted in the beginning, there is hope, right? I don't want to focus on the doom of ACEs, but as the video highlighted, when we can predict something, we can prevent it from happening, right? And if we're able to understand ACEs and the magnitude of ACEs and different challenges, then we can do something about it and potentially reduce not only ACEs, but negative outcomes associated with it, right? So this slide shows how you know, a decrease in ACEs can lead to a 44% drop in depressive disorders. It can lead to 33% decrease in smoking. It can address different socioeconomic challenges, such as unemployment. So you can imagine the loss of work productivity, sick days associated with ACEs, right? So understanding that if we're able to do something with ACEs and address it in the patients and the communities that we work with, then it can have multiple positive implications in improving health outcomes as well as social outcomes. So because I come from a public health training background, I always, want to understand these health issues in the greater context of society, right? So next objective of this presentation is really to examine ACEs using the socio-ecological model. But I know for many of you, probably interested in ACEs in the context of COVID-19, right? So ACEs, while they existed pre-COVID, they are still happening, may have gotten worse during COVID. So I think it's important to think through this public health issue of ACEs in the context of the current crisis that we're in. Right. So for those of you who might be less familiar with the socio-ecological model developed by Yuri Bronfenbrenner, it's really been used to inform preventive approaches for several decades. It's a way of organizing the web of factors into nested systems that interact and transact to influence the experiences of the child in the world, right? So understanding that ecological systems which contribute to child maltreatment are highly influential in the context of the current pandemic, knowing that the pandemic has influences on sociocultural norms, on society, on community, and on family, and of course, on the child. I love this image because I mentioned in the beginning that while the Filetti and Anda's seminal study on ACEs was groundbreaking and really, set the foundation for the work I've done, the work that others have done in the field of ACEs, we recognize that there are limitations to it, right? So there's this other part of describing ACEs where we look beyond the household, where we look at community level adverse experience, experiences, where we look at environmental conditions, right? So understanding that while ACEs, again, capital A, capital C, capital E, looks mostly at conditions within the household, that there are these external factors that also need to be taken into consideration, right? So if we're looking at the pandemic, for example, we know that the impact and the experience that people are having with the pandemic, it is not this great equalizer. Rather, that it's more of exacerbating or bringing to light existing disparities, particularly in communities of color, right? So we know that COVID death rates is 6 times higher for those who live in areas that are predominantly non-white, as opposed to their predominantly white counterparts. We know that the impact of the pandemic extends beyond being infected by the virus, right? So if we look at the violent events that happened in Atlanta and understanding these anti-Asian hate crimes, they're not necessarily direct infections, but nonetheless have affected the physical and mental health of populations of Asian descent during this pandemic, right? So what does it mean to look at the pandemic through those eyes and understand how the pandemic's impact on communities and families may be multiplied by historical and past trauma. So another image that I really enjoy because I think it helps be able to see the relationship and the connection between adverse childhood experiences, which I'm referring to as ACEs, and adverse community environments, right? So understanding that when we're preventing and responding to ACEs, right, adverse childhood experiences, because I know they both have the acronym ACEs, it requires integrated system-wide and multifactorial approaches to effectively prevent and mitigate the negative impact of ACEs, right? So understanding what are the underlying social determinants of health, right? So socioeconomic adversity, unemployment, poor and unsafe housing and living conditions, could have the largest populational impact on ACEs, right? So what does it mean to get to the root cause of some of the ACEs that we're seeing in the leaves and the branches of the tree, right? So what does it mean to create community, comprehensive community-wide programs, which have been shown to reduce child maltreatment and build community-wide resilience, right? What does it mean to make sure that resources are available to address the negative impacts of COVID-19, right? So I'll be going through that in the next few slides. So I wanted to summarize what the literature has shown, and this applies to both the global and domestic context, although my work has tended to focus domestically. I just wanted to recognize that by definition of a pandemic, it is affecting the whole world, and that ACEs are not, as you all probably figured out, is not limited to the U.S., but occurs in other countries, right? So there are direct and indirect pathways linking pandemics to ACEs. And I'll go through each of these in the next few slides. But the first is ACEs as relates to economic insecurity and poverty-related stress. So there is a large body of literature, both domestically and globally, that points to the link between economic insecurity and ACEs, including violence against women and children. While much of this is correlational, they've been able to see that economically insecure populations tend to live in locations with weaker access to health and legal services. There are higher rates of crime. On a household and individual level, economic insecurity has been linked to poor coping strategies such as substance use disorder, taking on debt, transactional sex, and other risky behaviors. Economic insecurity and negative coping strategies have also resulted in acute and chronic stress, which is a trigger for conflict, arguments, and intimate partner violence. Research from sociology on family stress models confirms this as an important pathway linking economic stress to intrafamilial violence that suggests that increasing economic security via social safety nets, i.e. cash and complementary services, particularly for poor households, can reduce ACEs at meaningful levels. So these shocks that we're experiencing could be large in terms of the economic implications of COVID. Households might be facing increased unemployment or reduced ability to work due to the location or nature of economic activities. Women in particular may be disproportionately affected by additional unpaid care, such as caretaking or caregiver work, which may be further decrease their ability to undertake paid work. And then lastly, even without direct shocks to earning levels, pandemics, as I'll show in the next slides, may incite temporary food insecurity and increased stress due to uncertainty about the future economic security and general well-being, so which in turn can lead to higher incidence and frequency of ACEs. So I think it's also important to understand the current pandemic in the context of other pandemics and prior public health emergencies, right? So prior pandemics and health emergencies, including SARS, swine flu, influenza, have been associated with problematic coping behaviors, anxiety, suicide attempts, and mental health disorders. So we know that we have this converging pandemic of a mental health crisis, right? PTSD, all of this associated with quarantines and social isolation, the limitations on freedom, right? So what are the different ramifications that this, all of this is having on mental health? Quarantines, though, can be particularly challenging for parenting with existing vulnerabilities and abuse magnified for children due to, you know, closures of school, stress, fear, uncertainty. And while quarantines may be implemented right now in the short run, there could be adverse effects on mental health for years post-pandemic, right? So for those of you who are clinicians on the calls or work in direct services with youth and families, what does it mean to address mental health challenges once we've gone beyond the current pandemic, right? And, poor mental health, mental disorders and related factors have been shown to increase risk for ACEs, which understanding also that being in a forced quarantine and social isolation measures in different research has shown this can be analogous to settings where forcibly displaced persons are relocated, right? So camps, temporary centers. The act of being quarantined or socially isolated can also increase exposure to perpetrators, right? Like, what does this mean to, as a person who's dependent on a perpetrator living in confinement with decreased freedom, decreased privacy, under circumstances of greater physical and psychological stress? There may be parents or individuals who exhibit controlling behaviors or further acts of violence as an adverse way of coping with the current challenge, right? So what does this mean for that to be projected to children or to women in case of intimate partner violence, or to men, right, in the household? Like, different forms of violence manifesting because of lack of poor coping mechanisms. So numerous forms of isolation as a control tactic have been documented, including social isolation, so that's from family and friends, functional isolation, when peers or support systems appear to exist but are unreliable or have alliances with the perpetrator. There's also physical or geographical isolation, where one doesn't have any means for talking or communicating with others. They live remotely. So just understanding that, you know, there's different forms of isolation, and, you know, even where a person might have a lot of friends and family around, you know, if they have existing relationships with the perpetrator or they have no way of communicating with them, then becomes even a greater challenge. Another pathway linking the pandemic to ACEs is this notion of disaster and conflict related unrest, instability, right? So I, going back to the socio-ecological model, right, it's affecting our society at large, right? This is not just a one community, one city, one family, right? It's our whole infrastructure has been tested by COVID, right? So, you know, what does this mean for our systems to have been tested in terms of transportation, food, sanitation, our legal systems, our security, governance structures, you know, different entities having to pivot and change the way they handle operations. So, you know, what happens when our whole infrastructure as a society is put to the test by COVID? So knowing this unrest and this instability in our infrastructure may lead to an increased exposure of children and their parents to unsafe and risky settings. There might be, you know, increased exposure, for example, to sexual violence and harassment during acts of procurement for basic goods such as food, water. There might be lack of access for paid workers in some areas due to insecurity or constraints, you know, breakdown in formal support roles. There could be a breakdown in general services that are available where, you know, for example, a child who usually goes to school in person. So for those of you who are in the education sector or who work in school-based health centers, you know, you might be able to usually rely on being able to see that child or that pediatric patient in the school, right? But what happens when that is taken away and, you know, the mandatory reporters, so to speak, that are in a child's life are not able to see the child on a day-to-day basis, right? So there's limited capacity to have that engagement with a system which is usually known to be, you know, a system of support for a child. So during this time, there's also increased exposure to exploitative relationships due to changing demographics, right? We know that more people are dying, more people are getting sick, that there's greater exposure to exploitative relationships, especially for those facing economic vulnerability, right? So we've seen this dynamic play out with the HIV/AIDS pandemic, where an estimated 32 million people have died from AIDS-related illnesses, and an estimated 17 million children have lost one or both parents, right? So this increased mortality and morbidity, I'm sure if you read the news or at least follow, right, like the increased deaths and hospitalizations related to COVID can put additional constraints on family networks who are supporting the children whose parents and caregivers have died or have become very ill because of the virus, right? So what happens to these extended family networks and the stressors that are put on them, you know, the increased barriers for children, as I mentioned, to consistently access sufficient and healthy food, medical care, and schooling. What happens with the short-term school closures that impact children's long-term opportunities. And in many settings, you know, what happens when there's this greater reliance then on sexual transactions to be able to obtain the financial or, you know, type of support for basic needs such as food and clothing because of these change in demographics, so that the persons that one might usually rely on are no longer present because due to falling illness or, you know, worst case scenario, death. So recognizing that many of you are in the healthcare field and are first responders, so of course, thank you for your service. But knowing that, you know, many of you, including on this call, health providers, emergency first responders are often the first point of contact for women experiencing violence, for children experiencing ACEs. And an obvious outcome of any pandemic is an increased burden on health services and first responders, right? I know here at the Community Health Center, Inc., which Weizmann Institute is a part of, right, there's an increased focus on COVID testing and obviously vaccine distribution, right? So what does this mean for routine health services and the contraction of those services because of the pressing needs of the current pandemic, right? So what does it mean when there's a reduced supply of essential services for survivors of violence? What does it mean when referral pathways may change because healthcare systems or staff have to redirect different staff or resources to address the more time-sensitive challenges of the pandemic or post-emergency, right? So there might be shortages in services in terms of health and legal services to address the immediate needs of family and children. Survivors who face difficulties accessing medical facilities may further be impaired in seeking justice, right? So understanding that there are also legal implications. Anecdotally, you might read in like the New York Times or here on NPR that they're looking at decreased reports of domestic violence, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the decrease, you know, calling in is actually leading to a decrease in actual intimate partner violence that is happening. There might be less willingness to seek help. There, you know, less visits to the emergency room because of perceived risk of contracting viruses. So this has played out in prior public health emergencies. So that is another pathway that could be related to ACEs in the current pandemic. So I know many of you are also familiar with the importance of information, right, and health literacy and knowing as we're understanding more about the virus, as we're understanding more at this is, you know, the timeliness of how things are changing in terms of safety precautions, in terms of the vaccine, anything related to the pandemic, right? Like it's been a multitude of uncertainty and constantly changing information. So what happens when a child or a caregiver doesn't have easy access to that information, right? So when we talk about knowledge is power. So if a pandemic is novel or survivors have limited information regarding the nature of transmission, perpetrators of violence may use misinformation or scare tactics to control or blame them. So understanding that perpetrators might not only withhold information, but also withhold safety items such as hand sanitizers, soap, disinfectant, protective masks. And finally, linking with mechanisms around economic insecurity, perpetrators might also withhold health insurance or economic support, which becomes even more crucial during this current pandemic, right? So understanding the social and economic repercussions of the virus, right? So understanding that there's this greater dependence or way of controlling and way of demonstrating power over persons by withholding knowledge, by withholding different resources. This is continuing on the prior slide that I showed, and this one really focuses on the inability of women to temporarily escape violent partners. And I'm mindful that, again, we're talking about capital ACE, right, capital ACEs, and one of them is about intimate partner violence. But I do recognize that violence can happen to anyone regardless of gender. But in this case, you know, women may opt to stay with abusive partners for a host of reasons, ranging from emotional attachment, psychological distress, financial dependence, fear that separation will elevate harm to their safety or the safety of their children. So each of these that I noted can be compounded in a pandemic. During a pandemic, women may worry about their physical safety or experience additional mental and emotional distress, making it more difficult to create necessary space in the relationship and mitigate immediate risk for violence. Outside of personal familial constraints, women's access to legal systems and safety support services can be limited during a time of crisis. We know that court officials across different countries around the world have advised to stay at home. Here in the U.S., hearings have been postponed. Some court systems have carved out exceptions for family law proceedings through reduced staffing at courts, which, you know, risks delays in the issuance of court-ordered restraining orders, separation and divorce proceedings, and child custody hearings. Related support services, including screenings at medical facilities and crisis support services, may also be impacted. And pandemics may also have effects on law enforcement operations, right? So in the context of COVID, they've observed through the ACLU, it was reported by the ACLU that police officers may be less likely to assess cases of intimate partner violence as high priority for arrest and detainment, right? Because they want to drastically reduce the number of people who are arrested and detained because of the challenges of COVID outbreaks and existing prison systems, which are already overcrowded. We know that this dynamic has also played out in during the Ebola outbreak, where police officers were hesitant to enter homes and conduct thorough investigations out of risk of disease exposure, right? So what happens when, you know, the entities that we've enlisted to protect and serve also have their own constraints? And then first responders, crisis hotlines, and different organizations have also noted that really the importance of making sure that their operations are still up and running, but understanding that there might be constraints on different nonprofit organizations, which have also suffered during the pandemic. So they're suffering in being able to stay afloat as, you know, financial constraints have been put on these different social service systems might limit their capacity to be able to support women and children in need. I also wanted to recognize violence perpetrated against healthcare workers, that healthcare workers are, in fact, you know, disproportionately at higher risk for workplace violence. Globally, women are estimated to account for approximately 70% of the healthcare workforce and the majority of those in informal care taking roles in health. So violence against female health workers and sexual harassment is endemic in the health and social sector, with female health workers experiencing violence at the hands of male colleagues, male patients, and members of the community. So I wanted to go over the different social determinants of health, right? So this is pre-COVID, our field was finally coming to terms with the importance of social determinants of health in influencing healthcare access and outcomes. So understanding that although the risk of COVID-19 to children is low, the risk of exposure to ACEs has substantially increased due to the social, financial, and psychological consequences of the ongoing pandemic. So the San Francisco District Attorney's Office had increased domestic violence reports and calls in the initial week of the shelter-in-place order and then dropped off. But as I said before, that doesn't mean domestic violence has decreased, right? Other states like Missouri have also reported drops, for example, in child abuse reports. But that doesn't necessarily mean that because there was a drop in reported child abuse, that there's actually, children are actually safer at home. And it might actually be the opposite, right? That the abuse is likely increasing with rising family stress, right? So I note here, you know, the increase in food insecurity, the increase in housing insecurity, right? The increase in violence because of poor coping mechanisms. Knowing that vulnerable children may experience COVID-19 very differently given the additional burdens that come with the pandemic on top of the infection aspect of COVID. So we know that mass unemployment has an adverse impact on the health, financial, and social circumstances of workers, family, and communities. Globally, people are reporting depression and anxiety symptoms have spiked since the lockdown. There's financial hardships and stress from confinement, increasing risk for suicide, challenge with alcohol and substance use disorder, negative parenting practices, loss of social support network. So as these social and economic stressors and household adversity accumulate during the pandemic, the risk of maltreatment experienced by children residing in an already volatile and risky home environment can escalate exponentially, right? So imagine children who are already exposed to ACEs pre-COVID and what happens when you add this additional stressor of COVID, exacerbating the current conditions and stressors that they experience in the household. We go back to that toxic stress, that cumulative stress, as stressors build in frequency, duration, and severity. You know, really understanding that these are key indicators of cumulative harm on a child's health, both in the current as well as long term. So I wanted to recognize that there are converging public health challenges, right? So in my home state of California, we had natural wildfires, right, that happened that devastated many parts of my home state, right? So that on top of the pandemic. Our country had a moral reckoning that, yes, racism is still here. It is alive and very much present. And the killing of George Floyd and of other Black and Brown and Indigenous populations only served to remind communities of color of the ongoing challenges of racism in this country, right? So understanding that there are ACEs and there are also these adverse communal experiences that are adding to the stress of the pandemic, right? So natural disasters, reminder and ongoing existence of racism structurally, interpersonally, and on different levels, right? So what happens when we have this cumulative experience of disadvantage and adversity? What happens to, especially for children of color, children in low-income populations, right? So relatively more vulnerable children, like what happens when you have these different stressors happening simultaneously, right? So the converging pandemics that we were talking about earlier in this presentation. As I started out in the beginning, that I went into this work because I really feel that part of my calling is to bring hope and healing, that the challenge of heart disease, diabetes, depression, anxiety in adulthood, intergenerational trauma and it being passed down to children, that the story doesn't have to end there, right? Like many of us, you know, chose to be in the public health or healthcare professions because we didn't want that to be the end story for family members, for patients, for community members. So as it said in the video, if it is predictable, it is preventable. So there are ways that we can address this. And my hope in the next few slides is to explore recommendations and opportunities for addressing ACEs through research, policy, and practice. I spend most of my time in research, so I consider myself, as Ina pointed out, as a health services researcher. The field to date has pointed out there are three ways of grouping priority research questions. All right, so first, I want to go over understanding the magnitude of the problem. So a basic way that we can address ACEs is to understand how big is the problem, right? We still are ways of surveilling the magnitude of ACEs is still wanting, is still a work in progress. We don't completely understand the magnitude of ACEs, particularly in the context of the pandemic, because of the challenges with collecting this data, with the challenges of providing the support, children and families to report on this data. But having this data can help us make decisions of how to allocate resources. It can help us understand the different types of ACEs, right? Because not all ACEs are equal, right? So intervention that addresses emotional abuse or neglect might be different from being able to create an intervention that addresses substance use problems, might be different from addressing issues of intimate partner violence. So we want to understand what's the composition of ACEs that's being experienced for individuals and populations during the pandemic. Are there certain populations that are more at risk for increases in ACEs? And then do these vulnerabilities map out along different economic and social inequities, including by sex, race, ethnicity, economic status, among others. So the challenge, as I noted earlier, is understanding that, you know, one of the first things you learn about in epidemiology, that association does not mean causation, right? Like, would the rates of ACEs, the prevalence of ACEs, still be trending upward or downward, even in the absence or presence of the pandemic, right? Is it necessarily because of the pandemic we are seeing this prevalence of ACEs that we are seeing? And I already noted the challenge of having reliable data, because without having the true numbers, so to speak, so there's more likely an underreporting of ACEs, we don't have a true understanding of the true burden of what ACEs that is existing right now. So a second research area is to elucidate mechanisms and linkages with other social and economic factors. What are the potential mechanisms of understanding that different populations might be at increased risk for ACEs, and knowing that because there are shortcomings to our current surveillance systems, what does it mean for us to, you know, not solely rely on quantitative data, but also leverage the lived experiences and the voices of women, men, and children during this time, right? So ethnographic work, qualitative work to explore, right? Are there different pathways to ACEs for different populations? Are there different social norms and collective behaviors that influence these different pathways? And then understanding, you know, when you incorporate for those, like myself, who engage in community-based participatory research, when you engage the voices and the lived experiences of the people you aim to serve through your research, then it helps you better understand how interventions can be tailored to specific communities, families, and children, right? Because you have a better and more nuanced understanding of the context. And then the third research area is informing intervention and response options, right? So I very much consider myself as an applied researcher. You know, there is research for research's sake. There's also research to make sure that knowledge is being produced that will inform change and hopefully positive change, and much sooner in a more immediate term, right? So some priority research questions in this area are, you know, are there policies and programs such as emergency cash transfers or unemployment insurance that can help mitigate against increase in ACEs? How does the timing, duration, and intensity of intervention affect short, medium, and long-term experiences of ACEs and future well-being, right? For like, is it enough to have one stimulus check, have one engagement? Like, how long, how much should our interventions be in play and these support systems be in play to ensure that, you know, adequate support is being provided in order to mitigate the impact of ACEs? Yeah, so before I go into, I wanted to point out also, and I probably a minority on this call, but there's also the role of philanthropy, right? Because of understanding that, as I'm pointing out here, supporting child development, and, you know, although we're talking about the different support systems, a lot of this takes funding, whether it be public funding or private funding. So understanding that philanthropy, government systems that, you know, and policies that dictate how much funding can go into different social supports is also important to point out. So on the other spectrum of ACEs is PCES, or positive childhood experiences, right? So I talked about the importance of having a trusted adult in one's life, whether that be a teacher, a parent, a family member, a sibling, nurturing factors such as access to health needs, you know, experiences that boost a child's confidence and sense of security. By having these experiences, right, it makes a difference between tolerable and toxic stress. Research has shown that children have been reported to have less concerns related to their mental health and relationships into their adult lives by having these positive childhood experiences, right? So what does it mean to understand that, yes, we are all in this pandemic, but we don't have to experience this pandemic alone, right? The looming reality and uncertainty that children face with us of this pandemic. So what does it mean to build resiliency into children by talking with them about their fears, how to cope with those fears, and the fact that it's okay to have those emotions, right? These planting these seeds, these positive childhood experiences or PCEs early in one's life can have positive ramifications across their lifetime. So I want to quickly run through different policies and program responses because of those of you who are interested in health policy and more are in the more programmatic side, which, you know, complements research well. So I just wanted to point out different policy and program responses. Concrete program and policy responses could include bolstering violence-related first response systems, right? So what does this mean? It means increasing staff or temporary operations for existing violence prevention and response hotlines, outreach centers, finding ways to share information virtually when, you know, if not everyone is able to receive information or support in person. What does this mean to make sure that information can be shared in a secure and private way so that users can quickly exit and no traces left behind in their search history? What does it mean to make sure that training of police and legal personnel are also offered, right, so that we recognize more the importance of trauma-informed care and trauma-informed services? So the importance of allocating funding to make sure that our first responders are adequately trained and supported to be able to provide the support that children and their families may need during this time. So the second is ensuring violence against women and children and these services are integrated into the health system's response, right? So what does it mean for healthcare providers, you know, to be able to identify persons who are at risk for violence, right? So maybe in areas where COVID testing and screening is being done, in areas where vaccines are being distributed, that there's, you know, this awareness of like being able to identify persons who might be experiencing violence at home, right? And what does it mean for our systems to be set up to be able to provide that high quality survivor-centered service so that it's not necessarily the responsibility of those who are focused on women's health or pediatric health, but that we equip different members of our workforce to be able to provide this kind of support and referrals as needed because of the shortage in workers who are able to provide such services. So there's this need to expand and reinforce social safety nets. So I talked about stimulus checks, but also, you know, what does it mean to increase employment benefits? What does it mean for employers to expand paid sick leave? What does it mean to expand, you know, availability of food voucher payments, so our SNAP and WIC programs? What does it mean to make sure that there's these different social support systems are in place and are readily accessible to mitigate the impacts of the pandemic, so mitigate the impact of food insecurity, housing insecurity, so that children and their families have the financial and social support they need to make it through the pandemic. So we know that temporary shelter and transitional housing for survivors of violence is likely to be reduced during the pandemic and be used for other purposes, right? Sheltering the sick and other vulnerable populations. There might be also high risk for contracting the virus in these spaces. So there's a need for surge housing to be available during this time and to ensure that this housing also ensures access to critical services like counseling, legal advocates. So what does it mean to assist children and their families in the short term, but also start preparing them more comprehensively in the long term? Research shows that informal networks such as family, friends, coworkers are likely to be the first source of informal disclosure for survivors across all ages, across diverse settings. So what does this mean to make sure that, you know, are mindful of the existence of these informal networks and leverage these networks? What does this mean to leverage online support networks as all of us are increasingly reliant on virtual platforms? So these different mechanisms may help women and children feel connected and supported and can also serve as an alert or mitigation mechanism for women and children. So the importance of clear communication and support during quarantine mandates. When we talk about trauma, we recognize that, you know, you can inadvertently cause trauma or re-traumatize populations, right? So what does this mean to make sure we're mindful of how we communicate about safety precautions, about quarantines, about social isolation, right? So that that's not just the messages that we're conveying and the good intentions, but the wording of it framing it in a way that reduces adverse mental health impacts. So the importance of the language that we use. Recognizing as, you know, we're becoming more aware of the need to look at health equity, that this, again, is not something that we look at as a one size fits all, right? Because we know that certain populations are disproportionately impacted by ACEs, right? So what does it mean to incorporate a race, gender, and age lens through our preparedness efforts, through the ways that we deal with ACEs, and recognize that the voices of those who are most directly impacted by ACEs are incorporated in policies and decision-making. Lastly, I wanted to point out the need to invest in flexible funding mechanisms, right? So what does this mean? It means, again, donors and implementers allowing for flexible funding, right? Like, how does this, to make sure that nonprofit organizations, those who are in the social safety nets and are providing for vulnerable populations, don't have to worry about the constraints that are put on with how to use funds, right? That they're able to have the flexibility to use funds quickly and efficiently. So I just wanted to point you all to this website that points out the different state level efforts that are happening across the country to address adverse childhood experiences during COVID. There's a lot of work going on in California, in North Carolina, in Oregon, and then you can read all about it on this website. And, you know, if Ina wants to share this afterwards, or you can email me afterwards, I'm happy to talk through more. But this is constantly being updated to recognize that, you know, state level government are taking measures to be able to address ACEs during this time. I wanted to point out ACEs Aware shows a variety of clinical screening tools. And then Steve, you can quickly just go through the next couple of slides. Because I just wanted to show that there are examples of clinical screening tools that are available. So this is one example, another, and then a third. It shows that there are different ACE questionnaires that are available both for adults and pediatric populations that are available in English, Spanish, additional languages for your use should your practice, if you are in a practice, decide to incorporate ACE screening where you are for R's of trauma-informed care. So you all are probably already familiar with the 4 R's of trauma-informed care, but just wanted to point out that this is another area in terms of understanding how can we better respond to ACEs, right? What does it mean to train ourselves, our colleagues, our staff in trauma-informed care? You know, the first step before you can be trauma responsive is being trauma-informed, right? So the importance of educating ourselves on being able to screen for trauma, to identify trauma, to be able to respond appropriately and hopefully not re-traumatize the populations that we aim to serve. So I just wanted to recognize the work that SAMHSA has done in terms of the core principles of the trauma-informed approach. So this can be found on the SAMHSA website. We do a lot of great work in trauma-informed care. So just wanted to point out these core principles of trauma-informed approach, which can and are still applicable to the current pandemic. So I also wanted to point out that the importance of strengths-based approaches, right? Oftentimes our healthcare systems rely on a deficit-based approach of like, what is wrong with the child? What, you know, what is all this abuse, neglect, this household dysfunction? But what does it mean for us to look at it differently and understand that there are strengths in a child's household, in a child's parents, and to approach a situation, approach a child from that mindset, right? So that we're looking more at expanding the good as opposed to solely focusing on the negative. And while it was not the focus of today's presentation, I do want to acknowledge the importance of recognizing and addressing secondary traumatic stress. If you are a healthcare professional or, you know, working directly with young people who might be experiencing ACEs, if you're in the direct service professions, secondary traumatic stress is real. I didn't have to tell you about that. But, you know, understanding that being able to connect with children, their families, with communities can be harder when we are dealing with our own fear and trauma and uncertainty, right? So what does this mean to also come to terms with our own challenges so that we can in turn become better providers, better clinicians, better servant leaders in our communities that we serve. So this can be found on the CVC website, but I've gone over all these different components throughout my presentation, but just really wanted to highlight that we all have a role in being able to address and mitigate the impact of ACEs. So it's not just one entity or one sector that is solely responsible for addressing ACEs and reducing its negative impact, but we all play a role. So my hope that you all walk away of knowing that yes, ACEs are highly prevalent. Yes, ACEs disproportionately impacts different communities. And yes, the pandemic has brought to light and exacerbated the public health challenges of ACEs, but we all have a responsibility and hopefully have the resources to make changes in policy, research, and practice so we can build stronger and more resilient children in communities. You want to open it up for questions?
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Damien. So we'll have time just for a couple questions. The first will be, what is the role of epigenetics in the multigenerational transmission of childhood trauma?
That's a great question, right? So it's always that the nurture and nature question. I am not a geneticist by training, but recognizing that environmental factors put stressors on our DNA and that can be passed down through generations, right? But it's the interaction between our DNA and the environment, right? So it's not solely transmitting the trauma gene, for example, right? But then, you know, certain injuries to our DNA, you know, do get transmitted generationally, but it is not the sole cause, so to speak, of ACEs, but can certainly make us predisposed because of, you know, as we've seen in terms of different behavioral health challenges.
Thank you so much. The next question is, I've heard of new frameworks such as racing ACEs. Has further research been done concerning the role of racism and discrimination on ACEs?
That's a great question. I mean, this is definitely an area where, you know, I focused my dissertation in terms of, I mean, when I looked at that initial study of ACEs in the population and knowing the different communities I've worked with, that it was very much lacking, right? We know that there is a lot of research on stress, discrimination, racism, stigma. That's why I brought up that it's important to also take in consideration adverse communal environments, the other ACEs that aren't talked about as much. So I think this is a growing area of understanding that the 10-item ACEs, which was a starting point, but cannot be where we stop as a field, right? Because it does not take into consideration these additional stressors, which have an impact on the same health outcomes I brought up earlier, you know, whether it be medical or behavioral health outcomes. So I know that there are a lot of researchers like myself, and feel free to reach out, who are invested in this area of understanding that because ACEs disproportionately impacts different patient populations, such as communities of color, low-income populations, that it is not enough to stop at the original 10-item ACEs, but we need to look at it in the context of other public health challenges, i.e. racism, discrimination.
Thank you. And I think we have time for one more question. Would it be helpful to implement some sort of ACE screening for all students who enter elementary, middle, and high school as a way to provide early intervention and refer to therapy if needed? Most reports do not happen until after the person is over the age of 18, and early intervention is key.
I completely agree with the participant who provided that question/comment. There's the field has largely focused, as the participant noted, on ACE screening in adulthood. And for me, who has my own bias and I focus on childhood, I feel like adulthood is too late as well. The challenge with some of the screeners that exist before 18 is sometimes they've asked or Screen for ACEs asking the parent, and what happens when the parent is actually the perpetrator of the abuse or the neglect or is experiencing the violence, right? They might be underreporting. So I think our field needs to find ways of, you know, being able to, as the participant noted, implement these screeners in critical developmental periods, right? So whether that be elementary, middle, and high school, and being able to do complete it in spaces where they can be honest with their responses, right? So if they're going to for their, you know, well child visit, or they're going for their annual checkup and their parent is in the room, they might not, you know, be more open to being candid with their responses. So being mindful of settings in which these screeners are administered is also crucial.
Thank you. So that will conclude our question and answer period. We'd like to thank Dr. Damien and you, the participants, for a great question and answer period and for joining us on this webinar today. We hope that you will be able to utilize the information presented today to strengthen your work. Thank you, and this concludes our webinar.